Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport. Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined today by Matt Kinnear and Kevin Brown as the trio of us waits to embark a cross-country trip to San Diego, where we will be for the next 5 days covering pool play of the 2023 World Lacrosse Men's Championship, which takes place at three venues. Snapdragon Stadium, which is San Diego State's football team's new stadium. They just completed their first season in the fall of 2022. As well as most of the Blue Division games, or excuse me, that is a very important distinction. Most of the Pool A games will be played at USD's Torero Stadium, and the remaining pools games will be played at San Diego State's Four Field Complex, which is at a third site. So, incredibly exciting moment. The ESPN schedule was announced last week. I believe seven games will be on linear broadcast. Every game will be available on ESPN+. And we are here to talk about the big storylines heading into the tournament. Kevin, Matt, how you guys doing?
Doing great. Nothing going on the cross these days, right?
No, that actually brings up a quick sidebar that we are going to indulge to get things going. Matt, you reported on Monday afternoon that Kevin Cassis, Lehigh head coach, will take the associate head coach and offensive coordinator job at the University of Virginia, joining Lars Tiffany's staff and filling in the role that had been occupied by Sean Kerwin since Lars moved from Providence to Charlottesville, as Kerwin took the head coaching position at Dartmouth earlier this year. It is one of the most substantial head coach to assistant coach moves in recent memory. The one that comes to mind, and a handful of folks that I spoke to also referenced, when Mark Van Arsdale left being head coach at Penn in order to join Dom Starge's staff. That move worked out very well for the Cavaliers. But obviously this is a unique situation, and you not only reported it, but also have some good depth and detail as to what led to it. So mind sharing a little bit about what maybe you know about Tiffany's recruitment of Cassis and Cassis' decision?
Yeah, for sure. And like you said, I think it's one of those things where, you know, you hear, oh, Kevin Cassis is going to, you know, take this new role at Virginia and not be a head coach anymore. It's pretty shocking, right? You know, when you first hear it. But then as you think of it, and, you know, as you learn a little bit more, it makes total sense. You know, from my understanding, from talking to Coach Cassis, is, you know, this is a way to get back in the national championship picture. You know, Virginia is a team that every year is going to be competing for a national championship. He's, you know, an associate head coach, so he's going to be, you know, an integral part in building that. Obviously, he's really close with Lars Tiffany, you know, so that makes this a little bit of a different, a smoother transition. You know, obviously, one of the things that you worry about if you're a head coach and then you go to, you know, a role where you're an associate head coach, assistant coach, whatever you want to call it, you're not your own boss anymore in terms of leading your own program. But, you know, being Lars Tiffany, someone he's been close with, he worked with him, you know, years ago at Stony Brook, his first job out of college after Duke. So that kind of eased his mind in terms of that. But, you know, like I said, competing for a national championship, you know, I read some of the message board things and there was a lot of talk like, oh, is he in hot water at Lehigh? Are they going to be struggling? And he's kind of, you know, get out of there before he's fired or something like that. No, that's just silly. Lehigh's a place he could have been for the next 20 years. If he wanted to do his whole career there and retire as a Lehigh Mountain Hawk, I'm sure they would have, with open arms, let Kevin Cassis do that. You know, this is kind of a quest to, you know, shake up his career. He's been there for 16 years. He started when he was 26 years old. You know, make the next step and kind of get back into that elite program coaching circle of, you know, compete for a national championship in the ACC. So Lars Tiffany actually came up with the idea and reached out to Coach Cassis, which I think is something that's really interesting and people didn't really read in the story. You know, so this is kind of some more outside the box creative thinking from Tiffany, what's worked for him to get two national championships at Virginia for sure.
And in addition to what it means for the Cavalier program, it obviously means a lot for the Lehigh program as well. And multiple reports, including by Ty Zanders, suggest that associate head coach Will Scudder, who is an alum who's been an assistant on staff for 10 years, will be promoted to take over the Mountain Hawks. And what's interesting to me is the dynamic within the Patriot League and certainly the way in which this job changed between when Cassis took it in the late 2000s, I believe 2008 was his first season, up through now. And ultimately, the most substantial change is that Loyola and Boston University are members of the conference, which wasn't previously the case. And what that has done is changed the pecking order at the top and changed Lehigh's ceiling, for lack of a better word, and maybe not necessarily their ability to win the conference. They certainly maintain that level and that standard and have shown in recent years that they are capable of that, both in terms of recruiting talent to Lehigh and being able to attain that standard, but then maybe more so in terms of how frequently you can expect to be at that level. And if you look at how they performed in that 2011 to 2014 range, when Loyola was just joining after being a member of the ECAC and kind of adopting the standards that the Patriot League imposed on their ability to take in transfers or grad students as transfers, and then Boston University, which was a startup program, getting, you know, kind of assimilated in. It's a tough task to compete against Army and Navy, who have 50 players on their roster that are on full scholarship, as well as a tradition like Loyola's, where it's the most prominent sport on campus and they've won a national championship, and Boston University, which is obviously in one of the most appealing markets that you can have a college lacrosse team in, and one of the most prestigious institutions in the world. Kevin, what is your thought on how this move changes the landscape either within the ACC or within the Patriot League?
It's just really interesting to see how these domino effects kind of occur in regards to, obviously, you mentioned Sean Curran taking the head coach job. He's thought of as one of the brightest minds as a young coach with the offensive game around in the sport. So him bringing that to Dartmouth is pretty neat. And then you still got Dave Metzbauer on the market with the parting of ways with North Carolina. So there's still dominoes to fall in the ACC, but seeing kind of Lars Tiffany hold no punches back and kind of get the best possible hire with Coach Kevin Cassis from Lehigh is definitely a really cool development to start the offseason.
Yeah, Kevin, you say, you know, no holds barred, kind of. And I think this what this reveals is really the gap that there is between, you know, these, if you want to call them Power Five schools or whatever the traditional powers, and just the amount of resources that a place like Virginia can have and can offer. You know, if you're looking at this as a downgrade, you know, obviously it's a shift in what Cassis is doing for sure. But I don't know if downgrade is the right word. You know, he's going to a place that invests so much into the program, and you know, it's tough to be, even if it's a top 20 team, you know, being a head coach of a Patriot League program with NIL, the transfer portal, you know, just how difficult it is to, you know, keep a recruit that you find, you know, maybe early in their high school process, and then every time an Ivy League school or an ACC school says, hey, I want you, you pretty much just lose them immediately. It's really, really, really difficult, you know, to compete at that level at a place like Lehigh. And you know, I'm not just singling out Lehigh, just all of those similar schools that are in that boat of like consistent 15 to 20 teams. You know, so like, and I had a coach text me today, and I'll read part of it. I'm not going to say who it is. It's not Kevin Cassis. You know, people have no idea how hard it is to be good at a school like that in today's landscape. NIL, COVID years, transfer portal have ruined college coaching. It's just like, if you want to win, you know, obviously you can catch lightning in a bottle at any place, but really the winning happens at kind of a select few conferences.
It's also really interesting to see the different approaches of how the succession plans have kind of unfolded with Lehigh. It's really the only one I can remember the last couple of years that had the immediate successor with Coach Scudder coming in. Not even Coach Tierney had Matt Brown waiting at least the duration of the season and then the couple weeks to make that decision final. So I thought that was a kind of cool piece of the puzzle as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a World Championship podcast, so let's get into the World Championship storylines. Matt, on Monday morning, you wrote an article that asked a very important question. Should Canada be the favorite? Why did you pose it that way, and what do you think the answer is?
Well, you know, Terry, I think you said this in relation to into college about, you know, the revenge factor and, you know, how much that plays a role. And obviously it's been 4 years, but the way that game 5 years. The way that that game ended, I think, really, really galvanized Canada lacrosse. A lot was associated with that. You know, obviously, they had the whole insurance thing that they went through when they went to Israel. I just think that there's an overall vibe of focus that Canada lacrosse has. They moved past that issue. They lost that game, and they really want to win gold and kind of get revenge for that. So I think there's just an overall element of focus. But more particularly in terms of the construction of the team is just how many guys are entering their, like, peak field lacrosse prime right now for Canada lacrosse. It's pretty stunning. You know, when you look back and, you know, you realize, you know, a guy like Shallon Rogers, who obviously had a career at Stony Brook, you know, he was part of the tryout process for Israel or whatever. You know, he was not quite this developed pro that he is now. The biggest example is obviously Dane Smith. You know, one of the, I think people would say he's one of the best players in the world, field and box. Obviously, he is the best player in the world. But he just played a smattering of field lacrosse at that point and didn't even make the team in 2018. You think of guys, gosh, you know, Josh Byrne was a special player even then, but now he's definitely one of the best players in the world. It just kind of goes on and on from there. Connor Fields is playing offense with them. You know, Zach Currier is obviously one of the best players and has been for a long time. But just the number of guys who are not just box guys who are playing field lacrosse, but seasoned field lacrosse, you know, veterans, experts, stars even. And I didn't even mention Jeff Teat, who is, you know, on a short list for best player in the world as well. So to that question, you know, I might say Canada's a favorite. If I'm making a pick right now, I'm picking Canada to win the gold medal. Obviously, I think even though it's a short tournament, these teams do change pretty considerably over the course of these events, and that really is what's going to dictate, you know, what happens in game one versus Canada-USA and versus what happens in the medal game. There's going to be a lot that happens in between and a lot that changes in between. But then you look at, you know, all the star talent that I just mentioned, but, you know, the specialty areas are, if they're not favored in Canada, they're at least in the running there. You know, they have all-world goalie Dylan Ward, who basically, you know, willed them to a gold medal win. And then they have, you know, at faceoff, when you look at Jake Withers and Justin Inacio, you know, Withers is a guy who's kind of stood toe-to-toe with Baptiste in the past in PLL games. So, you know, I don't think it's going to be a thing where, you know, Canada kind of, or USA has the edges, you know, the edge around all of the little areas of the game, so to speak, and ekes out the win. You know, I think Canada is a complete team with star power and kind of the grunt power as well.
Kevin, you are in the midst of writing an article about the U.S. national team, which had a training camp about 10 days ago, or at this point about a week ago. It will have been 10 days ago when USA and Canada square off on Wednesday night. What are the most significant storylines for the Americans?
I think just the first overall broad scope of how this roster is made up is pretty cool. With obviously, it's the World Men's Lacrosse Championship is a tournament in which veteran leadership is preferred a lot for this coaching staff. And you see a lot of new guys, though, come in. Most notably, Brennan O'Neill, the only college player, has coached John Donowski. His coach is the head coach, obviously, for Team USA. And then you got guys like Rob Pennell and Jesse Bernhardt, who have been here for, this is their third World Championships. Then this the second for Tom Schreiber and Michael Erhardt, who are both captains, along with Bernhardt, which was announced yesterday, as well as another all-world goalie in Blaze Reardon, the 2021 PLL MVP, who's playing on top of his game right now in some of his best lacrosse, coming off a 19-save game coming into these Worlds. So this looks like a very complete roster, but how it shakes out with what offensive pieces fit where and how they deploy some of their defensive weapons, I think, is going to be really interesting as we zero into day one.
Yeah, Terry, and I know you've spoken to the Haudenosaunee, you know, Coach Lars Tiffany, who we obviously just mentioned here. I know you've spoken to him. Their roster, I don't think people know the names as well, you know, just in terms of the personnel. Obviously, Zed Williams is on there, but he's in a different role than we are familiar with him carrying a long pole in this tournament. What do you know about the Haudenosaunee, and what should we watch for?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a really interesting tournament for them in a variety of ways. I think that one way is, you know, I've been following international lacrosse really since the 2010 World Championship, and that was the event where the Haudenosaunee weren't allowed to travel on their own passports to the United Kingdom in order to play in Manchester, and so as a result, they didn't play. And I thought that was very tragic on a number of levels, you know, certainly Indigenous sovereignty chief among them, and the international diplomatic components of it as well. But for me, from a lacrosse standpoint, what was so disappointing is, you know, as somebody who follows world football and you know, the Spanish national team was kind of entering their golden generation. It's a term that you've heard in global football for decades. And, you know, the Dutch went through their golden generation and the Spanish were at that time. And I thought that there was a lot of, you know, analogies or corollaries between that moment essentially starting for, at the time, the Iroquois, and the fact that they missed that tournament was going to be so significant relative to the experience they were going to be able to develop playing on that stage. And it's hard to remember 13 years ago that, you know, they weren't a kind of shoo-in for the bronze medal at the time. As a matter of fact, they hadn't won a bronze medal at that point. And so watching them in 2014, and, you know, for me, the memory will always be when Lyle Thompson had the most beautiful missed shot in the history of lacrosse, when he was being guarded by Brody Merrill off the end line, went behind his back, and then shot a low to high that went over the cage. And it's just a jaw-dropping highlight that, you know, 9 years later still is seared into my memory. And then, you know, in 2018, I think that there was a component of, I don't know, I don't really know how to describe it. Lars Tiffany was the coach, and you know, he was very familiar with the group, and I think the idea was that, you know, we needed a professionalization of our coaching approach in order to take best advantage of this roster and this talent that we have. You know, and I think that the challenge was to close the gap on the Americans and the Canadians, and I don't think that that happened. I do think that they separated and widened the gap between themselves and whoever was going to finish fourth or fifth in the tournament. And now, as you spin this forward, I think that it's fair to say that this is kind of the end of that golden generation, and there will be another that comes along. But we don't have Cody Jamison. There's no Sid Smith. Lyle Thompson has decided not to play PLL this summer. He is playing, you know, Six Nations. I'm not saying that he's nearing the end of his career, but, you know, he's in his ninth professional season. So certainly he is getting longer in the tooth than he is shorter. And he's flanked by a roster that doesn't have a backup faceoff guy. So Jeremy Thompson is going to be asked to do a tremendous amount. Warren Hill is an experienced goaltender, and Jack Van Valkenburg got international experience in the U21 World Championships in Ireland in 2022. But at the same time, the reason Zed Williams is playing defense is twofold. The first is because he wants to. He wants the additional challenge. And the second is because they need him to. And, you know, they basically have this binary of you know, Jake Pisenio is a Albany Great Dane, and he was right there with Richard Checo in terms of the cause turnover machines in Division One this season. But then at the other end, you've got Heine Thompson and Oakley Thomas, who are, you know, very long in the tooth, and Lars described him as like kind of like men's league in terms of the way in which they have duct tape on their knee braces. They're kind of being held together by baling wire. They've got some incredible talent at the offensive end of the field. And Toho Nanakoke, you mentioned the importance and role of Dane Smith. Well, Nanakoke was on that Bandits team that won an All-Champions Cup earlier this month. The unfortunate thing is that he sustained a foot injury in Game 2 that makes his status for the World Championship a little bit questionable. And then, you know, all throughout the roster, there will be names you know. Zach Miller is a player that I'm really interested in seeing how he shows up. The report coming out of the preseason scrimmage against Albany in February was that he was in good shape, so that's really good news. But the way that Lars described it is, you know, we basically have 17 attackmen on this team. And that means that you've got an attackman like Zed Williams playing defense. What it also means is that who's going to be running in and out of the box is going to be determined by essentially who has the best wind and stamina. I think that there is a way in which you can talk about the Haudenosaunee roster that is really informative to talking about this tournament in total. And you know, essentially the way that I see the storylines heading into this are USA versus Canada. Who's going to win? Very obvious. When you look at the last six tournaments, that is what has determined this tournament. And talking specifically about those two teams, given that they've now settled into this pattern where those two teams play the first game and then likely play the last game, what happens is you have four or five or six, depending on the tournament format, games in between when the challenge is essentially to get through it. So you've got this tone-setting game to open, and that has so much to do from momentum, emotion, and tactics. And then you've got this roughly week-long, you got to play a ton of minutes, and you have to win, but you also have to do your best to conserve as much stamina as possible, as well as not get injured. And then you've got to cycle up at the end. And if you win in the first game, you likely get a easier opponent in the semifinal, given the gap between the Haudenosaunee and whoever the fourth seeded team has been in the prior two tournaments. But even still, that hasn't proved to be a significant detriment in terms of the ability to prepare for the gold medal game. You know, obviously you mentioned the way in which the gold medal game ended in 2018. That literally could not have been closer. And then in 2014, the Canadians played the Haudenosaunee in the semifinal and advanced to win the gold medal. So that obviously wasn't a detriment in that circumstance either. So the second question that I'm interested in is, if the Haudenosaunee are easily penciled into third place, where is the gap bigger, between two and three or between three and four? And then the most compelling aspect of the entire tournament, in my opinion, is the hierarchy from four to roughly 15. I can make arguments for pretty much all of those 11 teams to slot in pretty much anywhere from fourth to 15th. And it's certainly possible that we might see one of them jump up and surprise somebody. Could they finish third? Could they finish second? I mean, if they were to finish second, that'd be the biggest upset in the history of the event that goes back to 1967. But if they were to finish third, you know, maybe that says as much about the end of this kind of golden generation for the Haudenosaunee as it does anything about the team that actually beat them. And then equivalently, you know, kind of cascading all the way down to 15, what I think is interesting is that you've got these rosters that are a combination of players who play a lot at home, and I think that on an outlier basis, England, Australia, and the Japanese fall into that category. The Czechs do as well, but I don't know how much field lacrosse they play relative to box lacrosse, and so, you know, we'll see how that translates. And then you've got rosters that are predominantly composed of American college lacrosse players like Puerto Rico, the Philippines, Italy. Israel is kind of a hybrid in between the two. And, you know, in addition to the Germans and the Irish, who I think are going to be very good as well, that kind of comprises that 11-team field. And I think it's going to be really interesting. And it's not to say that there isn't a team that falls outside of that that could potentially sneak their way in. But that's the way I'm going to watch this tournament. You know, for those of you that are on the East Coast, it's basically the pools 2 through 5 games, or pools 2 through 6 games are in like the late morning and early afternoons into the evening. And then the pool 1 games tend to start at 7 and 10 p.m. Eastern time. So it's a pretty easy way to kind of set your calendar starting on Thursday and running through Monday in terms of, you know, how you want to see, you know, the more than 100 games that are going to be composed or going to unfold over the course of the remainder of the tournament. So this is the first men's world championship where the field is determined by qualification. So it's limited to 30 teams, which is down from, I believe, 48 in Netanya, which is a function of a number of factors. Chiefly, it's very difficult to host an event with 48 global teams attending. But in addition to that, there is a need in order to spur competition locally and regionally for regional qualifiers to have meaningful stakes. And that is where you see global tournaments in every sport function as a result of their regional qualifiers. And so, you know, it was a little bit awkward in terms of the timing for when those qualifications occurred for this particular event because of the nature of instituting it, you know, whereas previously seeding had been based on finishing at the prior tournament. And so for all those reasons, it'll be really fascinating to watch how these teams come together and how they function over the course of the next 10 days in San Diego.
Yeah, Terry, you know, I spent a lot of time at the women's, you know, world championship that happened in Towson. And, you know, it's really just, you need to appreciate, obviously, the USA-Canada games are awesome. And, you know, basically, it is, I think anyone in lacrosse will say that, like, that is a peak core memory moment for them. You know, the players who have been a part of these teams, you know, right up there with their NCAA championship is, you know, representing your country and winning a gold medal is as good as it gets. But you really come to appreciate all of the traditions, all of the fun that, like, these other countries that, you know, you don't, you know, we don't write about consistently or you know, hear about. It really is a pretty special thing to watch all of them, you know, watching the haka and just like seeing things like that. But also just, you know, the fact that this isn't what the game all about. You know, everyone talks about, you know, grow the game or some kind of variation of that. And seeing like this group of people who like have discovered the game in some sort of organic way and, you know, aspire to play in something like this and represent their country. And just like, you know, it's a lot of sacrifice for a lot of these countries to, you know, travel here to raise funds and to, you know, basically spend 2 weeks of their lives on hold so they can play lacrosse and you know, get 25th place in an international tournament. So it really is in some ways the most pure form of the game that you will, you know, find and experience. So definitely encourage everyone to watch. And in terms of a, like that fourth through seventh place or whatever, I'm really excited to watch Italy play. You know, you're looking at their roster, and obviously we don't know like a ton about like how these teams are like, you know, constructed from a very, you know, specific roles of player level. But I mean, they got Zach Cole, they got Christian Cucinella, they got John Piatelli, Matt DeLuca in net. That's a pretty awesome like group of players that's gonna be playing for Italy. Like, I'm wondering, like, hey, are they gonna be competing for a bronze medal? Who knows?
100%. Yeah, I mean, for me, that's Puerto Rico. And what's crazy is that, you know, I think that there are some within the organization that are a little bit, you know, still focusing on who could have been there, which includes the likes of Keith and Jose Boyer and Andrew McAdory. But even still, you know, a group like a group that features Russell Melendez and Josh Barcasel at attack, as well as Brandon Aviles at the short 60 midfield position, they're going to be really fun to watch. And that's before you consider that Will Mark is, you know, the fourth best goalie in the tournament, maybe. It's going to be pretty remarkable. And certainly that is why we're going, because we're going to be responsible for keeping up on the developments each day as the event unfolds. But let's dive a little bit more deeply into the USA versus Canada matchup. And, you know, I think that for me, I don't want to say we like glossed over, but the starting point, whenever you talk to somebody who's either, you know, on the staff or adjacent to the staff, or just follows it closely, the starting point is the faceoff X. And it's not simply about the historical matchup between Trevor Baptiste and Jake Weathers. It's also about the fact that Jake Weathers is, you know, last we saw, he was not healthy, and he's currently not playing PLL as he finishes his Firefighters Academy. You know, Kevin, as somebody who follows the PLL, what can you say about what your expectations are for Jake Weathers heading into this tournament, and how do you feel like it's going to manifest in this matchup?
Yeah, no, I'm happy you brought that up, because the PLL rules this year are so different, and they have brought to light how much the value of faceoff wins has really gone down this season with the 32-second shot clock. That's the complete opposite case here in international rules sets, where the Canadians like to play a little slower pace, a little stall ball maybe sometimes to make sure they're not inexperienced defense, because they have Brody Merrill, who's probably the most experienced of any player in this tournament. But it's a defense that maybe isn't as strong as their offensive firepower at this event. So seeing Jake Weathers, I think my expectation for him is, coming off an NHL season that was super grueling with Halifax, I think he has gotten a chance to rest up a little bit and make sure he's all buttoned up for, he has completed the firefighter training, and he'll be back for week 4 in Minnesota, I'm told. So having him, and what makes him so good at the faceoff X is his ability to scrap. So he has two of the best wings on face-offs that you can ask for, and that built-in chemistry of them playing all together on the defending champion Water Dogs with LSM, Rylan Reese, and all-around midfielder Zach Currier, who's going to be everywhere at this tournament. That's going to be huge for Canada to get possessions and make sure the U.S. isn't, because my biggest question with this Canadian roster, is there short sticks, the defensive midfielders, and how they're able to stack up against how many weapons can attack this Canadian group down there. So the possession battle is going to be huge.
Yeah, I think the short stick question is an interesting one, because for me, Currier is, as you said, he's not a pure D-middy. I think Latrell Harris and Casey Wilson are going to be their pure D-middies. And Casey Wilson is at the other end of the Brody Merrill spectrum of experience. He is one of the least experienced players in these two rosters. Matt, is there anything that you can say about that position and how the coaching staff is approaching it?
Yeah, for sure. You're spot on in terms of, Casey Wilson and Latrell Harris are going to be their pure defensive guys. And, you know, Casey Wilson's a guy who, like, he put up a ton of points when you look at his junior career and, was one of those, like, offensive guys who, you know, came to Denver and, you know, Matt Brown and the Denver staff there, you know, realized, like, Coach Brown was talking just an anecdote about how they were playing a scrimmage in preseason and he just got caught on defense and he was like, oh my God, like, this guy's a natural defensively. Just his footwork was just so good. Obviously he has, the physical traits as well, but it was just like his footwork and ability to like have that innate defensive posture and stance was what really like, oh man, like we are using this guy completely the wrong way and put him as a pure defensive role. So, you know, those two guys. And then, you know, when you have Zach Currier and then, you know, Chalen Rogers is a guy as well who can kind of play end to end and play defense when needed, but will be relied on for his offensive touch as well. So yeah, that's, I think clearly the, you know, if there's a point of question, because like you said, Terry, a lot of it's going to be in the shoulders of a guy who, you know, basically is just starting his international career in Casey Wilson. And, you know, they're going against a U.S., you know, not going against a USA group of short stick D-middies, but when you look at the USA group of short stick D-middies, I mean, it's pretty incredible, you know, how we're kind of in almost a golden era of short stick D-middies when you see what they've done in the PLL the past few years. So that's certainly the one of the tipping point areas in this tournament. But, Casey Wilson's the guy that I think, you know, I'm planning on when we get out there talking to him and trying to write and, you know, explore him a little bit more to kind of inform the readers a little bit about his backstory. But he's probably one of the most important guys in the field. And, you know, he's one of the youngest guys in the field, too, in terms of the top division.
Kevin, who is the U.S.'s top six offensively, and where are they going to, like, who's going to occupy what role on the field?
Sure, and just to finish off Matt's point too, part of me thinks it's almost advantageous for Casey Wilson to be so young and have a kind of a naive sense coming into this. He's going to be attacked every possession, I feel like. So him knowing no other than to do his best and match feed as best as possible. I know there's another athletic Denver Pioneer short stick on the U.S. roster you alluded to is a part of this golden generation, him with Goodrich making up the short stick ranks for the U.S.
And you're referring to Danny Logan for those Tarasenko's listeners that don't know.
Yes. So his health is a big question coming into this. Obviously, he finished the NLL season a little banged up, and he's played in every PLL game. He finished the entire week three game against the Water Dogs, but those are just personnel questions to keep on following as we continue covering this event. And to your question about the top six offensively, the attack I expect to see out there is Rob Pinnell quarterbacking the offense from behind, flanked by a couple lefties. This roster is loaded with lefties. I mentioned O'Neill. It's likely that he's going to come out of the box. Matt Rambo and Kieran McArdle. Kieran McArdle is pretty used to playing that secondary QB role where he can kind of initiate when the ball is rotating and the defense is trying to get the different spots. And Matt Rambo does Matt Rambo things, and the slower pace game of the international rule sets, I think, will kind of benefit how well he can take it to these strong and physical Canadian defensemen. And then you look at the midfielders, Connor Kelly coming in with some newfound confidence after an inspired performance to end the international break for PLL, and then Tom Schreiber is another guy who has health questions coming in with right knee tendonitis on the injury report the last couple of weeks for PLL action. But he's obviously Captain America coming off that controversial gold medal winning buzzer beater in 2018. Expect Charlie Bertrand to be that lefty on that first line. So how much does O'Neill get first line midfield runs? And like you mentioned, Terry, the way this roster will unfold, like the handful of games they have to play after this opener against Canada on Wednesday night is going to be like so much offensive firepower that they're just going to do so much damage against some of these other defenses that it may shake up significantly as we go forward. But that's kind of how I see the top six as re-enter.
So if the top six defensively for the Canadians is, I think you can expect Owen Grant, Brody Merrill, and Graham Hossick to start down low, Rylan Reese to run at LSM, and we've already talked about the short stick rotation. So if that's the scenario, and that is the top six, I would anticipate you see Brody on Pennell, Grant on Hossick, or I'm sorry, Grant on McArdle, and Hossick on Rambo, with Reese on Schreiber, and then the Harrison and Wilson on Bertrand and Connor Kelly. Is that how you guys would expect that to unfold as well?
Yeah, it's really pick your poison, because you look at Pennell versus Brody Merrill. I mean, that's he can kind of win that matchup with speed over the aging vet, as well as good as he is off ball. He just doesn't have it on ball as he once did. But I think what you were getting at, Terry, is trying to match that physicality with Hossick and Grant with some of these Rambos, and obviously McArdle is a physical dodger as well.
Yeah, I'm curious what Merrill's role is going to be. You know, obviously he is Canada. You know, he is the guy. He deserves to be there, and his leadership is, you know, I think everyone who's played with him, you know, says he's one of the best leaders that they've ever played with in the world. But like, where do Cam Wires and a guy like Patrick Chume, who had an awesome D3 career, you know, where do they fit into this as well? And do they play more minutes than Merrill? Is Merrill used in some sort of other situations? And for Canada, I think that, like, we're probably going to be a little less specific on the answers, because there are no answers at this point, given that they didn't really have a training camp. You know, they were playing, they had so many guys playing in the NLL finals. You know, their training camp was basically the last few weeks of pro lacrosse. And that's important, because I think winning and the culture of winning that they've established the last 4 years in terms of the number of championships that were built on, you know, a core of Canadian players is pretty significant. You know, when you look at the both PLL champions and then obviously, you know, the Bandits and the Mammoth, you know, the past few years with Dylan Ward leading the Mammoth and Josh Byrne and Dane Smith for the Bandits, you know, I think they're more of a work in progress. And like, we don't know who is going to kind of fit into each role, because they don't know yet. They just got there and they had their first team meeting Monday morning. They didn't have the luxury of some of the training camp efforts that Team USA did. You know, so I look at this offense, and obviously I think Jeff Teed is going to quarterback this offense. but like, is it going to be him and Connor Fields and Josh Byrne as the starting attack? That would be my guess. But you know, where does a guy like Curtis Dixon fall into that? And, you know, do you move Connor Fields to more of a midfielder role? You know,
I just don't a lot think, of those. I think that the starting attack will be Curtis Dixon and Ryan Lee. And I think that it's going to be really interesting how they try to load up the dodging from the midfield. And I say this on the basis of having watched Matt Brown offenses, you know, dating back to the Halcyon days of Denver and what he did moving Jeremy Noble to the X attack role over the course of the tournament after losing the opening round game in 2014. And I think that the way in which they're going to want to play and why I think Connor Fields is going to be or an invert weapon out of the box is, you know, with Josh Byrne's slickness and speed and Dane Smith's power, their ability to initiate on, I mean, could the U.S. double pull? Absolutely. And would you probably prefer to have a pull, you know, on those two guys at the expense of having a pull on certainly Ryan Lee, who's, you know, still only, I don't know what, 13 months removed, not even 13 months removed from an ACL injury. And then also, you know, Curtis Dixon, who's probably 35 or 36 years old. You don't need to leave a pull off of both of them, but you probably would. And I would probably assume it would be Lee that you would double pull off of. And then, you know, in that scenario, if Westberg is the third midfielder on the first line, I mean, the amount of shooting and the angles from which they're going to be able to shoot simply by initiating with Smith and Byrne getting the ball to Teat, and then Teat's ability to throw guys open in incredible positions or dodge off the attack. Like, a little bit of a peek behind the curtain, Matt, I'm not saying that you don't believe that Canada should be the favorite, but I will say that I think I informed your thinking because I believe that, and I believe that I will hand up, fully admit that I am struggling to move on from how dominant they were in Birmingham. And I will fully concede that sixes is a completely different game. When you look at the 2018 and 2014 gold medal game final scores, it was 9-8 and 8-5. Okay, so it's reasonable to set the over-under on this year's gold medal game at 15.5. And in that scenario, when the Canadians are going to protect the ball really well, what does that mean for Rylan Reese and Zach Currier and Chalen Rogers in terms of their ability to push transition? Is it too risky to take a shot in transition, miss, and lose the backup? In that scenario, you know, you go from essentially being able to run an 80, 90, 100-second possession into a 10-second possession. And that is a thing that they are very good at that they probably won't want to risk not taking advantage of. And if they don't push in transition, then you're probably going to see a low possession game and you're probably going to see another low scoring game, which mitigates a little bit that offensive prowess that those guys are going to have. But I just, you know, lacrosse is not a game where the team with the best player always wins the way that basketball is. But at the same time, like, if we were drafting these two rosters, I mean, how many picks in would we be before Teat, Currier, Smith, and Byrne were off the board? 5? 6? I mean, is it realistic that, you know, 4 of the best 5 or 6 players in this on the field are going to be on Canada's side?
And just the fact that, yeah, like the fact that seeing Dane, Byrne, and Teat play together for the first time and them gelling so well together and being so dominant. I believe that was the first time last summer during the six, obviously a different discipline with sixes. But Terry, just describe what those three bring to any highlight reel, any offense that is so hard to stop.
So the first is that they can dodge for their own. So they are dangerous. You want to slide to them. You don't want to slide off of them. They all three can catch and hammer, right? But the biggest thing is that they dodge to feed. And specifically, Dane and Josh dodge to get the ball to Teat, who is one of the best passers, if not the best passer in lacrosse right now. And it's funny because being a good passer comes in a lot of different ways. A lot of good assist makers are really good dodgers who get to dangerous positions on the field, draw two, and then can throw the ball to the open guy. And then the open guy scores a goal, right? That doesn't necessarily make you a good passer. It makes you good at making one pass after being a really good dodger. Then there are good passers who are willing passers and throw the ball accurately. And then there's Jeff Teat. And I've had guys try to convince me, because I was down on Teat relative to the whole ecosystem in 2018-19, and they were just like, you don't see it, you're not looking at it closely enough. And what they would say is, the ball flows through him. And what I interpret that as is decision making. And what it means is that he has such a good barometer for when to take an incredibly high risk for an incredibly high reward and potentially throw the ball out of bounds versus making an easier pass in order to get a good open look or pulling the ball out and running it again. And in international rules, that's a really valuable thing. And I think that what Byrne and Smith provide is incredible athleticism that is different and very complementary. I mean, I think Dane Smith is a power dodger and Josh Byrne is a speed dodger, but that undersells Dane Smith's speed and Josh Byrne's power. And so, like, they're just really, really good players. And, I'm not basing this on kind of even the emotion, right? The revenge factor. I am basing it on how committed to the rope-a-dope strategy Canada is, how much I believe they want to lose the first game in order to have the U.S. right where they were on them. How much the fact that Jake Withers hasn't played in PLL and that's being seen as a source of caution or concern. Like, Jeff Snyder was in the exact same position multiple times and came out and competed mightily and scrapped to 40%, which is all Canada need in order to control enough possession in order to dominate the game. So I don't know. I will say the one difference, in my opinion, is Blaze Rudin can steal the game. And it's not to discredit either John Galloway or Jesse Schwartzman. Brian Docherty was able to steal the game, had the capability of stealing the game in 2010. I think that Jesse and Galloway were both like going to do a good job of controlling the defense and making sure that the seven-man unit was being most effective. Blaze Rudin can steal the game if things don't go well for the United States. And so as a result, like, I don't feel super strongly, like I don't think I would bet. I just think that if I were setting the line, I think it's prudent to favor Canada.
I'm pumped. I mean, it's like the, I'm trying to think of a hockey analogy here. And I was thinking of, Jeff Teat is obviously like so much like a Wayne Gretzky like figure, you know what I mean? Like the way that he plays. So it's like, you know, this is a reference no one is going to get. I guess we have a Canada audience who's going to listen to this one. So maybe, but it's like, you know, it's like Jari Kurri, Mark Messier and Wayne Gretzky out there, you know, like 1980 Edmonton Oilers, in terms of like Messier being this just like power forward, you know, in the Dane Smith role, and like, you know, Kurri kind of and Josh Byrne, you know, like this more of like a creativity role. And then Jeff Teat just being like the guy that like brings it all together. So there's a reference for nobody. I think they were only aligned for like 1 year too. So it doesn't even...
Kevin, do you have any NBA analogies for our audience as far as the Americans are concerned?
the big three in Miami.
Right to call out how left-handed this offense has the capacity to be. And you know, if a couple guys get injured, you might end up seeing four lefties on the field at one time, which would be absolutely insane. So, the only lefty that is super prominent in the NBA right now that's coming to mind is James Harden. So I don't know, what would an offense look like with four James Harden and two Steph Currys on it?
This whole conversation though is, we're talking about who's the favorite, and it's like the favorite is the team that doesn't get hurt. It's like, and like, or whose injuries are not as bad as we perceive them to be. How many guys have we rattled off of like, oh, he's coming off an ACL injury or this or that, or, you know, even Schreiber, Kevin, you mentioned earlier about, you know, him having some injuries to deal with, and who stays healthy is going to win it all.
I don't question that at all. And especially like, I don't question U.S. ability to get stops against this offense. Canada's going to score goals, but the Rowlett, Dunn, JT Giles Harris is just such formidable close defense that I think we'd be remiss without just at least mentioning them on the podcast. Blaze, you mentioned, and obviously Dylan Ward's got the ability to get in shooters' minds too, but just that defense, I expect a heck of a lot from this next week and a half.
All right, well, I got to go catch a flight. That'll do it for this edition of the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. Kevin and Matt, safe travels as you head out on Wednesday, and we'll be back later in the week with more Inside Lacrosse podcasts, and make sure to check out all these games on ESPN, ESPNU, ESPN Plus, and anywhere else that you can find them.
Let's go.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.